fourth Aliyah of Parshas Vayera is very significant, and this is where we start the Makos. This is where the plagues begin, and there's a lot to try to understand about this whole process. So we'll begin by looking at the Psukim. So here the Torah tells us, so God gives the command to Moshe and Aaron, the discussion whether he speaks to Moshe to speak to Aaron or speaks to the two of them together. But ki daber aleichem paro lemor tzvu lachem ofes v'amartel Aaron kaches matuchah v'hashlech lefnei faro yidu l'sanim. So Paro is going to demand some kind of a proof, some kind of indication that they are who they say they are. So bring your staff and you'll throw it in front of Paro and it will turn into a tanin. So it's the question what a tanin is. Rashi says it's a snake. Reversh insists over here that it's not a snake. It's a different kind of animal, some kind of a aquatic monster, perhaps a crocodile. And that's relevant in terms of understanding what it is. It's relevant in terms of what the symbolism is. So according to some, the symbolism of a tanin specifically is because this language is also used to describe Paro. So perhaps the symbolism is that he will be eaten up, just like we see happening in this Mofes with those of the Mitzrim, or that maybe the same way is going to end up turning back into a stick. So too, Paro, despite this fearsome imagery, he's going to be turned into dry wood. Rabbeinu Bachya has a perspective which is working off the premise that it's a snake, and he suggests that just like the snake ends up causing problems through speech, so too, that's what Paro did, and that's meant to draw a parallel. And there is a strong parallel there, because both the Nachash and Paro, in terms of how they use their speech, is they call into question who is God and what is his influence and what is his power. So perhaps there is that idea that if indeed we are talking about a snake here, that parallelism is being drawn. So Vayavo Moshe v'Aaron al Paro v'yasuchein kasher tziva Hashem v'yashech Aaron es matayu l'fnei Paro l'fnei avadav v'yil l'sanin. So indeed, this is what happens. This is what happens. Aaron throws down the mate, and it turns into a tanin, whatever a tanin is. Vayikra gam paro l'chachamim l'machashfim v'yasu gam hein chartumei mitzrayim balahatayim came. So they were able to do something. What exactly they did is also a discussion in the Rishonim, in the Mefarshim. So it could be that they were able to use their magic to essentially do the same thing, to also create some kind of creature. The Ibn Ezra understands that it's not actually literally they were able to do the same thing, but they were able to create an illusion that they were creating these creatures. If you look in the Malvim, he has a whole story here about how they really had to kind of fake it, that they got the hides of dead Taninim and smaller people put them on and wriggled around, and it seems like a pretty pathetic display, but I guess this is what they were capable of doing. So they pretended that they were these creatures by dressing themselves up in them, and perhaps that's what happened. Did you have a question?
Yeah, just going back before the tanin, is that also could be like a nafkamina, what like the taninim gedolim are in Bereishis?
So that's a part of it, trying to figure out how it correlates to those psukim. And also the question is, there are different definitions for land creatures and for sea creatures, so there's a whole history behind trying to determine that. So one way or another, they imitated these creatures, whether they were actually able to use magic to do so, or whether they were doing so through some kind of an illusion, or whether they did so through a really kind of pathetic display, but they created something. And what happens after that? So v'yashlichu ish mateyu v'yu l'saninim v'yiv l'mate aron es matosam. So however they created this appearance, so Aaron's stick, which was the real thing, that was able to swallow up all of their other sticks. And the Gemara Masechet Shabbos on Daf Tzadi Zayin Amud Aleph, the Gemara says that this was a nes besoch nes, that there was something here that was doubly wondrous. So the Torah Tumima and others understand it's because it's not just that you have one tanin swallowing up another, but that it specifically does so after it turns back into a mateh, after it turns back into the stick. So that's particularly miraculous. And some also suggest that to take it another step, that the stick didn't change, didn't get any bigger after consuming all the other sticks. So there was additional miraculous imagery here to make the point even more so that there was something very unusual happening here. So the pasuk continues, telling us about a very significant phrase, which really requires a lot of discussion and perhaps introduction. This is one of the significant theological challenges of these parashios, comes up again and again. So here the pasuk says, "V'chazak leiv paro v'lo shama lehem kasher diber Hashem." So here Paro's heart was hardened, and he did listen to them just as God had predicted. So the whole role of hardening of the hearts of Paro and the Mitzrayim in these parashios, which comes up again and again, is a major point of discussion from the perspective of philosophy and morality. All the Mefarshim try to figure out how is it that it's fair that the Mitzrayim should be punished and the Paro should be punished if God is playing a role in strengthening his hearts. So it seems like the deck was stacked against him. It seems like it's not really fair. He doesn't have Bechira. So how could it be that they're held liable for this? So this pasuk specifically, how it fits in is a part of the discussion. So does this mean that Paro hardened his own heart? Or does this mean that Akash Baruch Hu hardened his heart, as was predicted before this? So most of the Mefarshim understand that this means Paro hardened his own heart. The Rebbeinu Miuchlis writes that Kadosh Baruch Hu was doing it, but Paro was doing it more. And this is significant as far as trying to understand the whole issue here of hardening of the heart, because in general, the question of how it's fair, so there are some who suggest that even though it's axiomatic, even though it's an ikra of amuna, that we all have bechira chafshis, and therefore we are responsible for what we do because we have free will, but it's possible that kings are different because history is affected by their decisions. So maybe it's not always possible for kings to have complete free will. But others suggest differently. Especially, it's hard for that to be a total answer, because even if it is true that kings are restricted in their free will, but that's not going to explain why they deserve to be punished. It could explain the decisions, why certain things have to happen because of the needs of history, but it's not going to really address the issue of why it's fair for them to be punished. So there are other approaches, and some that are relevant here, and especially specifically for this stage, is that the idea that you have free will to make your decisions, so that is, yes, that is crucial as far as the fairness of life and why it makes sense to receive a punishment because of the decisions that you make. But when it comes to tshuva, when it comes to changing your path, so that's a gift. The possibility of tshuva and the potential for redemption is not a given to everyone. That's a chesed of Ribono Shel Olam. And sometimes it's more just that that not be available, or that it not be available so easily. If somebody is continuously making the wrong choices and doing avaris willingly, so it's not going to be a given that he's going to be able to change path on a dime, or maybe even not at all. So the fact that Paro initially creates his own problems is a very significant factor here in why he deserves not necessarily to have the opportunity for tshuva later. So the Torah emphasizes that, at least at the early stages, Paro is choosing to harden his own heart, is making his own decisions that are impacting how he's going to behave. And because of that, this is going to affect his potential for redemption later. It's not going to come so easily. And perhaps as far as justice is concerned, it's equally relevant in that direction, that it shouldn't come so easily. It shouldn't be possible for somebody who chooses to create great harm that as soon as he decides he's ready, that he should be able to flip things right away. Instead, it's more just that it should either be withheld from him or at least be a much harder process, something he's going to have to work harder to overcome. And this is consistent with what's often quoted from Ruth Dessler in Mechtav Milio, when he talks about the notion of Bechira. He says, yes, it's true that we have the ability to choose a path, but it doesn't mean that all options are open at every moment. There is a Nakudas HaBechira, that there is a point where we have a range of decisions, and that's different for different people depending on their life circumstances, but most importantly depending on their decisions. By your repeated decisions, you put yourself in a certain context and your choices may be limited at that moment. So we are being told that Paro made decisions that made things harder and harder for him, and that got him further and further entrenched. And then later on, when maybe there could have been a possibility for him to flip, so Akash Baruch Hu makes it harder for him to take those opportunities, and that itself is justice. And it's also relevant that there's some Mefarshim who understand that maybe the whole idea of hardening his heart is actually to make it more genuine. That when there's tremendous pressure coming from the Makos, so then if Paro is going to give in to that, so that's not going to be really reflective, that really he wants to continue oppressing the Jews, but he can't withstand the pressure, so he's going to give in, but that's not going to really be fair in terms of reflecting any great tzidkus on his part. But if he's given extra fortitude to be able to resist the pressure from the Makos, so then his true self comes out, the fact that he indeed doesn't want to let them go. And perhaps that's what's being conveyed. And it's possible that's relevant here also, that whatever chizuk is being described here is his ability to ignore what's in front of him, and his ability to say that, okay, because he wants to persecute the Jews, and even though maybe another person would have seen these miraculous things and would have said, wow, that's impressive, maybe I should change course. So Paro wasn't given that extra chesed, so to speak. He wasn't given that normal reaction that people would have and say, maybe, okay, maybe I should be forced to change my path. But instead, his true free will, that he wants to continue oppressing the Jews. So that's what happens. So, okay, so God reports this in the next pasuk, Yomer Hashem Moshe, he's refusing. His heart is hardened, however that happens, and he's refusing to release them. So now the Makos are going to start. So go to Paro in the morning. He's going to be by the river. The Gemara Masechet Moed Katan, and Afir Chesmer Aleph tells us that Paro was an Amgushi. You know, what exactly an Amgushi means, that's a machlokus in the Gemara elsewhere in Masechta Shabbos and Defayin Hey. There's a discussion where that means, whether it means that he was a machashef, that he was a sorcerer, or whether he was megadef, that he was a blasphemer. And one way or another, he would spend time by the river, either to do his sorcery there or to assert that he was the god over the river. So that was a part of his ritual. So he would go to the river, and Kadosh Baruch Hu was telling Moshe that specifically that's where you should confront him. And this language of lacrosso, to greet him, is actually a discussion as well, whether that means to be confrontational, specifically to take that moment to start up with him, or maybe it means to be respectful, to recognize he's a king and you need to talk to him in a certain way. But one way or another, this is what Moshe is being told, to meet Paro at that point and to confront him. V'hamata shenepach le'nachash tikach biyadacha. And that's also a part of the message. You're reminding him of what you can do. You're going to have this staff together with you, and that will remind him that this is a powerful force of confrontation. So here we're going to now get into the Makos. So I'll just mention for a minute that Rav Hirsch has a lengthy introduction to the whole concept of the Makos, and we know that the structure of the Makos is very significant. It's something that we talk about during the Seder, and the whole acrostic, the different ways to group the Makos. There's a lot to understand about the order and about how they're conveyed in the Torah, and this is something that we'll see now from here to the rest of the Parsha and the Parsha's bow as well. But just to say a few words from the introduction that Rav Hirsch has,
He notes that the Makos are in three sets of three. Makos Bechoros is its own category, so just to deal with the first nine. So the Makos are in three sets of three, and each one is set up with the first two have warnings and the third without, and the idea being that the third is a punishment for the failure to heed the first two. And he suggests that there is a set, each one of the three, is meant to address three different avos, three different injustices that Mitzrayim imposed on the Jews. So first is the geiros, as he puts it, the fact that they were made to be strangers, that they were deprived of their rights. So that's something that the Mitzrayim have to be held to account for, the fact of the slavery. And within that, the extra affliction, the inui, that was imposed upon them in the context of the slavery. So each one is meant to speak to a different aspect within the each set. Each one of the three is meant to address that. And then the three sets as a whole, they're also meant to talk about different contexts. So the first set is about demonstrating God's power over water and land. And the next is about God's power over the people in the land. And the last three are about the atmosphere that surrounds the land and the inhabitants. So that's how he explains the overall structure of these first nine. And he adds there that the first of each of these stages requires Moshe to rise early and to meet Paro at the river in order to issue this warning. And the part of the context is that you should understand, Paro, that your future doesn't depend on the graces of the river and of nature, but rather on a Kadosh Baruch Hu. So indeed, this is what happens. V'yamarte lov, Hashem Elokei Ha'ivrim, Shalachani Yilech, Ve'emor, Shalachis Ami, V'yavduni Bamidbar, V'hinei Lo Shamata Eko. So this is the message God has sent me to tell you. You should let the Jews go, and you haven't listened until now. So Ko Amar Hashem, Bezos Teda, Ki Ani Hashem, Hinei Anochi Makeba Mata Asher B'yadi, Avamayim Asher Bayor, V'nefchu L'dam. So here, I am going to strike with my rod, and this is going to make the waters of the river turn into blood. So this idea that it turns into blood, really that's very significant. It's a whole discussion before Shem. Really the point is that the water became spoiled. So whether it's about the color of the water, about the substance of the water, how this affects other water, the different takes in the Meforshim, but essentially on some level it turns into blood, and that has representational messages as well. So there's different takes on how this is considered midah keneged midah. And the Medrash, there's a few perspectives that it reflects the fact that the Mitzrayim wouldn't allow tefillah for the sake of midah in order to prevent the having of more children, or maybe because they made the Jews draw the water as part of their menial labor. Others suggest that the imagery is that, especially connecting blood and water, that they spilled Jewish blood like water, or because they threw the babies into the river, or because Paro claimed that he's in control of the river. All of these are possible messages of the Midah Keneged Midah, of why the river is affected and why it's turned into blood. Bahadaga asher bi'or tamus uva'ash hayor bin ilu mitzrayim lishlos mayim hayor. So the water is going to be spoiled, and the Egyptians are going to give up hope of drinking from the ore. And Rav Hirsch comments here also, as far as the significance, that here the Mitzrayim alienated the Jews, so they're going to feel alienated from their own land. They're going to feel like they're not able to drink from the river. That's essentially imposing that same kind of experience on them. And the pasuk continues, "Vayomer Hashem Moshe Amar Al Aaron, Kach Ma'atachun Ite Yadcha Al Bemi Mitzrayim Al Harosam Al Yorehim Yal Ad Mehem Yal Kol Mikve Mi Mehem Yudam V'Hayadam Chol Eres Mitzrayim U'Be'itzim U'Be'Avonim." So here we see that this is being conveyed to Aaron to do, and indeed that's what the next pasuk tells us. V'Yasu Chay Moshe V'Aaron Kasher Tziva Hashem V'Yarm V'Mata V'Yachas Amayim Asher Bayor V'Nei Paro V'Nei. So this is indeed what's happened, but the idea of it being conveyed specifically to Aaron, we know Chazal tell us that's because Moshe had Hakaras HaTov, and he was grateful to the river for protecting him during that time when he was a baby. And that whole notion of Hakaras HaTov here is very significant as well. The idea that Hakaras HaTov is not specifically about manners, about being polite to somebody who's benefited you, but it's about recognizing the fact that you have benefited, and it's about an internal mentality and how that impacts everything else. So that's highlighted here because of the fact that even an inanimate object, no one thought that there were emotions or free will associated with the river, that it decided to help Moshe. But the fact that he's able to appreciate that this impacts his life, we find this lahalacha, the Gemara in Baba Kama says that if somebody drinks from a well, they shouldn't throw rocks into the well. So it's the same kind of idea. The well is inanimate and doesn't have bechira, but you're supposed to recognize how your life was benefited because of someone or something, even inanimate, and to have Hakaras HaTov for that. And the Meiri writes over there in Baba Kama that you shouldn't even think badly about the well. So that's two steps removed from any actual connection to a benefactor, because it's inanimate objects, not going to know what you're thinking, but it's about your attitude. It's about how you appreciate how you have benefited. And that's the crucial message. So indeed, this is what's happening. So now the pasuk continues. So their magicians were able to do something with their power, and that also ends up supporting Paro's decision to be stubborn and to stay firm. And there's a fascinating discussion that Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky has over here on this pasuk. It's relevant to a lot more things, but it's printed to Emes Liakov specifically on this pasuk. And he raises the question, we read about all these magic powers. We mentioned before, there's somewhat of a debate of exactly how effective were their magical powers, and that's going to come up again in the Siliya. But it seems to a certain extent that Torah is telling us that there is a power of magic in the world, and that these people, even the bad guys, are able to pull off some pretty impressive things. So Rabbi Yaakov raised the question, how come we don't see this anymore? How come today we don't find this happening in our lives, that we see that there's magical forces that are able to accomplish things like this, or demonic forces? And he suggests that that the Kadosh Baruch Hu allowed this in the world, specifically when there were overt miracles also taking place. So when a Kadosh Baruch Hu's miraculous nature is being evidenced and is being perceived by people, so then to give them the option to explain it away and to not be impressed by it, so there's also the existence of magic in the world, so then people can just believe, okay, it's magic, it's not really a Kadosh Baruch Hu. So in order to preserve that bechira, so that's why it was something that existed in the world. But nowadays, since we don't see overt miracles either, so we also don't see these counter forces of magic. And he suggests that that's also a pshat in the Rambam, that there was a major machlokas between the Rambam and almost everybody else, that the Rambam maintains that magic, which is prohibited by the Torah, is prohibited because it's fake, because it can't really actually accomplish anything. And many others disagreed with him, even the Vilna Gaon disagreed with him in strong terms in his commentary to Shulchan Aruch, where he wrote that there's more in heaven and earth, Maimonides, than is dreamt up in your philosophy. I think we talked about this a little bit earlier in the year, that there is a possibility of magic. So the truth is, you have to account for some Gemaras and certainly some Sukkim, which certainly make it sound like there is magic. So Rabbi Yaakov suggests that maybe the Rambam's view is, yeah, once upon a time there was magic in the world. That when there were Nis and Guyim, there was also magic around to give that as an excuse, so people who didn't want to believe could blame it on that. But nowadays, around them is saying, in his days already, okay, so there isn't any real such thing as magic. But I think it's important just to contextualize what he's saying, if I'm understanding him correctly, because this is sometimes a complicated theological point. I don't think he's necessarily saying that magic existed in order to make it harder for people to believe, in order to create the Nisayon. It's a whole discussion whether we believe that Akash Baruch Hu is trying to put obstacles in front of people and trying to test people as far as their emunah. So I don't think that's necessarily the message here, that it's made to make it harder. But you also have to preserve Bechira, that if it was just so overwhelmingly obvious, if miracles were so clear and undeniable, that there's no way for any human being to have any other conclusion other than God is present, so then that would take away all role for Bechira. So it has to at least be possible that there's another option. So if there's a way of reading it differently and saying it's a miracle, saying that it's magic, so okay, so then you have the Bechira and the fact that you choose to appreciate it as something significant, that counts. But it's not necessarily that we're trying to make it harder for people, but we're trying to preserve the Bechira and consistent with what Rabbi Yaakov says. So of course, nowadays, technology is so advanced, so there really isn't any need for magic to be the alternate theory, because it could be anything. There's so much science out there that hasn't even yet been recognized. And so, as one writer once commented, that any science, if it's sufficiently advanced, is imperceptible, is indistinguishable from magic. So essentially it serves the same role. So that's also going to preserve the Bechira and allow people to deny God. But it's also perhaps very relevant to the next pasuk, because there's a phrase here which is important to appreciate. Pasuk says, "Vayifen Paro v'yavol v'yisol v'lo shas libo gam v'zos." So Paro turned away and he didn't pay attention even to this. So this language of paying attention, so that's perhaps an important phrase, that a big part of Yirat Shamayim, recognizing God in this world, is about paying attention, is about choosing to notice something and to recognize when something is extraordinary. So here, Rebecca was saying in the previous pasuk, if we want to contrast it, that there is this opportunity not to pay attention. When you see miraculous things, you can say that's not going to impress me, because it's magic around this technology and there's other things that could be doing it, so I'm not going to pay attention to this. But that whole midah of paying attention is very much connected to Yirat Shamayim and to all of its power. So that idea is something that connects to what we spoke about last week. If you recall, it's a parallelism or a synergy between the fourth aliyah last week and this week, that part of the godless of Moshe Rabbeinu is conveyed through the fact that he did pay attention, that at the burning bush, when he noticed, and we mentioned last week that that itself required attention, because if you just looked for a second, you wouldn't necessarily think there was anything so significant about a bush on fire, but be able to realize that it wasn't consuming the bush. So that's what requires attention, and the Torah emphasizes that Moshe stopped and made sure to pay attention. So there is perhaps a contrast here, these opposite midos, and that's something that's also very significant. So Vayachru Kol Mitzrayim Sevivo Sayor Mayim Lishdos Kilo Yachu Lishdos Vimei Hayor. So they couldn't drink from there, so they dug wells. Vayomale Shavas Yomer Machrei Hakos Hashem Sayor. And 7 days passed. Vayomer Hashem Moshe Bo Parv Yamartelav Kol Mar Hashem Shalaches Ami Vyaduni. So now go back again and tell Paro to let the Jews go. So now, if you're not going to let them go, so I am going to send the Tzvardeya. So what exactly does that mean? What animal is this? So the tradition has it that it's a frog. That's how we usually understand. That's what Rav Hirsch writes as well. He says, even though they could argue about the translation, he says, presumably it can't be crocodiles. It could be that the Tanin was a crocodile, but presumably it can't be crocodiles, because that would have decimated the Mitzrayim right away. They would have just eaten everybody, and that would have ended the whole story. So he emphasizes that whatever animal this is, frogs or something like that, the point is that they are meant to be annoying rather than dangerous, and that that's the nature of this makkah. Did you have a question?
I mean, there's still a bunch of makkos after Arov, and they weren't decimated.
Correct. Right, but here, the idea that this would have put crocodiles in everybody's house, and everybody's bed, and everybody's oven, it would have been pretty impossible for anyone to survive. So,
is that not what Arov was?
I don't know if it's to that extent. You know, the way it's described here is being literally everywhere.
Right.
So it would have been impossible to survive. So the nature of this mak, as he writes, is to be annoying rather than dangerous. And as far as the etymology, it seems like this is a word that comes from other languages. There's a whole discussion in general about where you find in the Torah words that come from other languages, although once they're in the Torah, they become Lashon HaKodesh. But he notes there that it seems to be parallel to Aramaic words, a combination of safar, meaning warning, and dea, meaning knowledge, the idea that the normally innocuous frogs, they make noise at night, but once the day comes, so they're quiet in the morning. The Yalkut Shimoni has understanding here that it's like a type of bird, the relationship between reptiles and birds, we know. So it's like a tzipor dea, it's a bird with knowledge, meaning that it's a smart kind of bird, knows when the water is safe to drink, has a power of discernment that's associated with it. But okay, so what's going to happen here? They're going to be everywhere, as this next pasuk comes to emphasize. Visharatz hayor tzvardayim v'alu v'ol b'beisecha u'v'chadar mishkavcha v'yal mitosecha v'beis avadecha u'v'yamecha v'sanarecha u'v'mesharosecha. It's going to be everywhere. It's going to be in your bed. It's going to be in the house of your servants and your people, and also in your ovens. And here it's emphasized the ovens are on. They're not just empty ovens that the frogs are going to decide to hide in, but they're going to actually even be on, and it's going to affect everything. And the Gemara has a very striking statement in the Gemara Pesachim on Daf and Gimel Amud Beis that Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah, when they decided to let themselves endure the Kivshan Shalesh for Kiddush Shem Shamayim, that's something that they learned from the Tzvardeim. They learned Mesiras Nefesh from the frogs, who jumped into hot ovens in order to be Mekadosh Shem Shamayim. So they realized that they had to do that also. And the Gemara says, the Kal V'chomer, the frogs didn't have any tzivui to do that. And that's something that they learned as a Kal V'chomer from them. So there's a story brought that the Shagas Aryeh, who was an older generation than the Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon was a child when the Shagas Aryeh died. But that Vilna Gaon, as a child, met the Shagas Aryeh, and he was able to answer up a question that here the Gemara seems to say that the Tzvardayim didn't have any command, and they motion nefesh anyway. So it doesn't seem like it's true that God issues this command that the frogs should rise up. So apparently they did have a tzibui. So the Vilna Gaon really impressed the much older Shagas Aryeh by answering the question. He said that yes, there was a command for the frogs to go all over the place, but not all of them had to go into the ovens, so that was only a few of them. So the rest could go to safer places. So the ones that decided they were really going to be Moser Nefesh chose to do so, and that was what was so impressive. So clearly there's a deeper meaning here in terms of the whole notion that the Tzvardayim have any kind of behir, any kind of decision, but the symbolism was very powerful, and this had an effect on Hanani, Mishael, Azariah, and they realize that they also have to be Moser Nefesh. And as the pasuk goes on to say, they're going to come on all the people. And the first comments here that the Egyptians will see that not even the smallest creature is afraid of them or has any respect for them. And that's going to have a tremendous impact. So again, like you said, it's annoying. It's not necessarily harmful, but it carries a message. And that's going to have a tremendous impact. And just like all of the areas that the Jews were affected in terms of their slavery, so too, the Mitzrayim are now going to be restrained in that same way, and that's also going to convey a important message to them. So, Vayomer Hashem al Moshe, Amor al Aaron, Niteyet Tziyadcha b'matecha al Naharos al Hiorim, V'al Ha'agamim, V'ha'ales ha'tzfardayim al Eretz Mitzrayim. So bring up the frogs and make that happen. So he did all this, and the frog, apparently singular, came up. So Rashi has a comment on this about whether it's a linguistic reason why it's singular, but he also quotes the idea coming from the Gemara Masechet Sanhedrin and Daf Samach Zayin that it started off as one frog. And because the Jews hit, every time the Jew would hit a frog, every time the Mitzvah would hit a frog, so then the frog would multiply. So they ended up having so many zillions of frogs because they hit the frogs and they multiplied. And the Stipler, the Sefer Birkas Peretz, the Stipler and Sefer Anchomish, has a comment here that is widely quoted, a very significant comment. It says, clearly the question that comes to mind is that if they saw this was happening, that when you hit the frog, it multiplies and you get twice as many frogs, so then why don't you stop hitting the frogs? Clearly that's very counterproductive. And he comments here that this is a part of the nature of kas, that when someone gets frustrated and angry, so he acts in a counterproductive way and he does things that are against his own interests. And that's what's reflected here, that in their frustrated and angry reaction to what was happening, they end up just making the problem worse. And in general, that's what kas does. It makes problems worse. It doesn't help anything. It's all irrational. And that's what's being conveyed here. So here you find again, really the third time in this aliyah, the next pasuk continues and it says, so the Chartamim, they did the same thing. They were able to do that also. So it sounds like they were able to make more frogs. And again, coming up a few times in the Saliyah, it really prompts the question, so why would they want to do that? Especially coming off the previous pasuk, so we just discussed how it was counterproductive to do something which results in there being more of the problem. So presumably they wanted to stop the problem. So why would they have the magicians come and just expand the problem? So he suggests to Hirsch that maybe it doesn't refer to the result, but rather it refers to the action, that the same kind of things Moshe and Aaron were doing. So they tried to do the same actions, but they were trying to do the opposite. They were trying to turn it off. They were trying to reverse the problem, but they don't succeed clearly. And so eventually they give up and they have to call for Moshe and Aaron. So that's what happens. Next pasuk tells us, Vayikra Pharaoh le Moshe le Aaron, Vayomer Hatiru el Hashem, Vyaser Tzvaradim Mimeni. So indeed, Paru gives up, at least at this stage, and he says, okay, come and daven on my behalf. Here, this is a word that we find a few times, that for a powerful language of entreating, of begging, of hoping, and that's we use that mean tefillah. So you should pray to your God that he should remove the frogs from me and from my land, and then I will let you go. Caleb?
Could it be that also that Pyro just didn't care about his own people, that he was so intent on showing that all this Hashem business is just a bunch of magic and sorcery, that was more important to him than saving his people? And that also in the pasuk that you were talking about, when especially given Rashi's explanation that Moshe was going to pray immediately and just wanted Pyro to specify a time that the frogs should go away. If Pyro really cared about his people, he would have said, Moshe, make them go away now.
Okay,
whereas he's willing to endure another day of this.
Okay, we haven't read that pasuk yet, though. You're right, so you're addressing something that is a question, but we haven't seen it yet. So let's...
I was asking a question on that and on the Chartamim part.
Yeah, that was the fact that he...
That both seem to have an underlying... could also have an underlying theme.
Okay, so let's come back to that after we read the next pasuk, because it's going to be relevant... this next point, what you're saying. So what are you addressing? The next part. So I'm giving you a little bit of autonomy here, that you can come and show some power. So you tell me, what should I do? So you tell me when I should daven on your behalf and when I should change things, then they'll only be left in the yor. So Vayomer Lamachar, Vayomer Kitvarcha Lamanteda, Ki Ain Kashan Alukain. So he says, okay, so you should do it tomorrow. And he says, okay, so that's what's gonna happen, and you're gonna see that there's nobody like God. So now to come back to Caleb's comment, so it was more really pointed towards this, because that's clearly a question that the Morshim try to figure out. That here, so they're desperate and they're calling for Moshe to say, okay, turn this around. And If that's the case, well, why doesn't he say immediately? So Moshe is saying that I'm going to let you decide when it's going to happen. So why doesn't he say, okay, get rid of them right now? So that's what Caleb was addressing a minute ago, that maybe it shows on one level that Paro doesn't really care about his people and that he's sacrificing them towards his ends. And clearly that's a theme. There's clearly a lot of that going on. And if that's hard to relate to, we see that in the news. I think I saw that they said that 117,000 Russian soldiers have died so far in this war against Ukraine. And you see what it's like for a leader just to sacrifice huge numbers of his people for whatever grandiose visions that he has. So it's not hard to imagine a leader with that type of disregard for the well-being of his people. So there's no question there is that aspect here. But still, it's hard to understand why he would specifically say, if he has control over when it's going to happen, so then let's wait a day, let's have it happen tomorrow. And with Simchas Lesubroid, in his comments, the Sefer Sandarach, so he suggests, and it's also relevant to understanding a lot of the dynamic here, that Paro was interested in knowing really what is the story here. And that perhaps when it comes to magic, so magic to whatever extent it existed and was effective, was only effective in a direct sense. You couldn't say, okay, I'll do a spell now, and sometime later in the future it's going to have its impact. Either it's going to work right now or not at all. And he really did want to try to figure out what was going on here. So he says, okay, so if it's really coming from your God, so then I want you to pray now, essentially. That's not saying you should pray tomorrow, but pray now. And if you really can control things, that it's not going to take effect until another day, it's not going to kick in until tomorrow, so that will itself be a very impressive message. And that also, if that's the case, so it speaks to this mixture of delusion and perhaps subconscious realization of reality here and willingness to self-delusion, that Paro realizes deep down that there is something going on here that's very significant and that there is a God in control of the world. But he also is allowing himself to be deluded and to convince himself that there are other things going on. And that's where there's this constant push and pull, and there are moments of clarity and moments of openness. But at the same time, he's allowing, whether it's his bias or his desire to persecute or other types of instincts, to overcome that. And that whole interaction of midos is essentially what we were referring to before, the whole aspect of hardening the heart, to what extent Paro is hardening his own heart, to what extent HaKadosh Baruch Hu is contributing to that or allowing that to happen in order that justice truly prevails in the end, and that it's not going to simply flip because there is a potential to change things. A very complex interaction here, both about human nature and about divine justice and about Hashgacha and Bechira. So very, very crucial themes that are coming out here in this Aliyah as we begin this process of the Makos and the stage of the Geula. Very significant messages that are emanating here from this Aliyah, but also as far as what it tells us about our own capacity for self-delusion, about how we let other instincts and other desires get in the way, even when deep down we really do recognize what the truth is, and even when we do appreciate where we should be going, we let other things get in the way. And that ultimately, as far as what is just and what is fair, about the impact that that has, and sometimes the much longer road that we create for ourselves in order to go back when we travel down the wrong path, all of that is being conveyed through this very powerful and complex Aliyah. So a lot to understand, a lot to internalize as we think about this stage of Geula, and as we read in Parsha this week, so much of this foundation of the future of the Jewish people and this episode that it needs to go through and that the Mitzvah need to go through in order to bring that about. Hopefully it should be a powerful lesson for all of us, and it should be a schus for the whole world that all of the destructive leaders who act in ways that are counterproductive to world happiness and to the well-being of their own people, should also find the lesson shown to them in a way that's powerful enough in order for their decisions to be reversed, and that the world should find the true redemption that ultimately the Jews are charged with bringing about. So I wish you all a wonderful Shabbos. It should be the four Lashonos of Gula with that message that we seek to play our own part in bringing about a true Gula for the world. And I wish you all only good things. And we'll see you, God willing, on Sunday.